Okay, so I'm here with Adam Johnson, who's most recently the author of The Orphan Master's Son. Adam, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine. I'm glad to be here. The weather's beautiful in New York.
Yes, and, uncommonly, yeah.
And we're in a kind of cool cafe where everyone looks much smarter than I am.
Oh, really? Well, so are you a native Californian?
I grew up in Arizona.
Okay.
But I've been in California probably since 1998.
Yeah. So naturally you had, of course, this wonderful ocean and countries beyond that ocean to sort of draw inspiration from.
I see the connection
away. Yeah, exactly. Well, I actually wanted to ask, I mean, stylistically, the first part of this book, it requires a great leap of faith for the reader. I mean, we're asked to believe that Jeanne Doe, despite the fact that his story does not check out, the interrogator releases him, that he would also go to Texas with Dr. Song. I don't think I'm revealing anything, really. I don't think I'm giving anything away. But then you have this twist at the end of the first part. Then we are given this surprise, and we say, oh, maybe the narrative itself doesn't exactly match up. Then you have the second part, and the last 100 pages almost mimics Casablanca, which, of course, is a DVD, the world's best movie, that is circulated as well through the text. You have all these references to storytelling. You have Sarge saying, you think the guys at top don't know the real story? You have Commander Gaw wondering if he couldn't tell a story that seemed natural enough to them now, but upon later consideration might contain the kind of message he was looking for. So we're led to believe that storytelling, or perhaps this dim awareness of narrative, is really very much the North Korean identity. And I'm curious how you arrived at this involuted solution to North Korea in terms of, you know, why this would be, of all things, their identity.
Well, storytelling is my obsession. I love stories. I love to write them and to read them. And I'm really fascinated with how they come out, especially troubling stories.
Yeah.
You know, happy, funny stories are very easy to tell. Stories of success and achievement. They're a little boring, but, you know. I've studied for some time now, maybe, how people tell traumatic or painful stories and the different shapes that they take. And when I started studying North Korea, it made me reconsider how I tell my own stories or the stories I tell myself to feel good. In America, I think in our literature and in our real lives, everyone's the center of his or her own story.
Yeah.
And our job as humans and as characters are to follow our motivations toward what we want and need, to overcome obstacles by looking inward and growing and changing and making discovery toward becoming our best possible selves.
Yeah.
But, you know, as I study the stories about North Korea, because the story there is state-sponsored, I realized it was a national narrative written by a regime, enforced by a regime, controlled by censors, without another version. And in that, the very few people at top were the central characters.
Yeah.
Really, the main character was Kim Il-sung, Kim Jong-il, and Kim Jong-un now. And everyone else in that country was like a secondary character. And this is really borne out by my research and by the testimonials of defectors, that when you're a child in the DPRK, early on you're assessed for your aptitudes towards certain qualities or the needs of the state, and you're sent down paths that will lead toward becoming a fisherman or a sailor or an accordionist. And in that world, having your own desires and yearnings could run counter to the role that you must fulfill to survive.
Sure.
So, you know, I think I started with a character who's more trapped in a world of North Koreanness, where he must do what he's told, go where he's told. He does grim things. And it doesn't really matter who he is or what he does. It's just that the role be fulfilled. Whereas in America, you know, we change our stories all the time. They grow and evolve. And when you go off to a new school or a new job, you just take on a new persona.
Yeah.
Change. And I think over the course of the book, because the character meets Americans, he listens to foreign transmissions because he has some encounters, even though he doesn't defect, even though he keeps maintaining his role, a growing sense of possibility rises in him that he could finally write his own story rather than being conscripted into the state. And in the second part of the book, he does this daring act to try to become his own person, though there he has to impersonate someone else even.
Absolutely. Well, secondary characters, I mean, this book is filled with them. And I'm wondering if from the limited resources you had at your disposal, I mean, you did, in fact, go to North Korea. We can talk about that a little bit. And so I suppose it's an intellectual subject. But I'm curious if you could truly, from your vantage point, get a suitable Tolstoyan cross-section when the information you have at your disposal is so thin. I mean, do you feel that there were certain secondary characters you didn't quite include in the book, or that may have actually been included in the previous draft that you would have liked to have fleshed out further? You know, how do you go about creating a fictive population when the information at your disposal is so thin?
Well, I did kind of revel in the secondary characters in my book. I'm glad you point that out, because I had a lot of fun with them. You know, just in terms of North Korea, what we know and what we don't know. We know very little about what happens in the seat of power in Pyongyang.
Yeah.
The people who are ruling, who are inflicting power upon others, we don't know that much. For the lives of normal citizens in the rest of the country, in Wonsan, Nampo, Chongjin, etc., we know a great deal, actually. Over 6,000 people defected last year. When they make it to South Korea, and that's its whole journey in itself, they go to a facility called Hanawon, in which they're debriefed, and a real narrative is written about each one of them. And then they go through a kind of school that helps them reintegrate into a vastly different society. But from the information that's gathered about normal citizens, we know how much they eat, how many hours they work, how their families live, about their housing blocks, about their group criticism sessions. We know how much volunteer labor they have to, you know, give to the Juche squads, etc. The mysterious people are in Pyongyang. They don't tend to defect. They're all underground. When you go to there, there's no White House or Blue House. There's no residence of Kim Jong-il. He lives in an unseen place in the city. A lot of the big structures are underground, partly because we bombed them so mercilessly during the Korean War. And there is an underground society that exists, and we don't know much about them at all. I saw cell phone towers when I was there, but not a single person on a phone.
Yeah.
We have to assume they have the internet, that they understand about the world, that they watch movies. They probably make international calls, even travel internationally. But because they don't leave, because they don't leave any trail, we just don't know who they are. And what I tried to do in my book was maybe fulfill the human dimension of the normal people outside the city. And by that I mean in a place with such self-censorship, in a place where even being perceived to do something against your role as the state could cost you dearly, I wondered how normal people chose to share their inner thoughts. This was the imaginative part. A lot of the factual basis of the book is really accurate. But, you know, would a parent tell a child that he thought it was all a lie? Would he transmit that essential knowledge that he accumulated over a life? Because that would keep that child human and real to some degree, but it would also imperil that child. It'd make them less able to function in a world where survival matters. And when it came to Pyongyang, and we do move to the seat of power as the book progresses, a lot of that was just speculation based only on a few testimonials.
Well, a few testimonies. I mean, I'm interested in this question because I know that you spent about 2 or 3 years trying to expand this initial short story, and then you indicated that you have felt a sense of duty as you listen to more testimonials of people in the gulag to do right by them. And my question is, I mean, one could cite the Stephen Crane idea. He never saw a single battle when he wrote The Red Badge of Courage.
Right.
To me,
which is why he wrote it.
Yes, well, there you go. To me, it seems that you function sort of between the person who has seen it all and the Stephen Crane idea.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering, you know, what you do to invent or fill in the gaps
for what you don't know. I mean, what? How did you marinate your mind for this? Was there enough to read? I mean, how many rabbit holes led to nothing, or led to a scrap, or led to a bit? I'm curious very much about this.
Yeah. Well, again, you know, when people get their tattoos cut off, when people guard corn from the farmers with rifles, details like these are all, you know, pretty factual. We have verification for them. But especially in Pyongyang, it's an unknown. And especially in the gulags. About the Kwanli So system, which is the irredeemability camps. We have a book by Kang Cho-won, The Aquariums of Pyongyang. And he writes about his 9 years in Camp 15. Which he was imprisoned with his whole family. It's a family camp, and when you go there, your parents and children and brothers and sisters go. And if you don't have relatives, your friends go through no fault of their own. And it's through this means that the state terrorizes the people most maximally because they start editing each other for any misperception or mispossibility. But, you know, Kang, in his testimonial of 9 years in Yodok, you know, he teaches us how to eat a newt, that you snap its head, but you have to eat it head first, and you never chew a newt, he tells us, because it emits a toxin in its skin that will make you vomit it up, and you won't get the nutrition.
But no first-hand experience eating newts for this book. Did you try anything along those lines? Did you steal chestnuts or whatnot?
Well, the thing is, no one else has gotten out of Yodok,
yeah.
So we can't verify anything he said. Another narrative, Shin Dong-hook's story of escaping from Camp 14, is the most horrifying human narrative I've ever really come across. And yet there's no way we can see. Even most of what we know about the dear leader's inner circle comes from Kenji Fujimoto, who was his sushi chef, and in a feat of great absurdity that had to do with an episode of The Iron Chef, he escaped. And we can't verify anything Kenji says, though he's our main source for Kim Jong-il's love of horseback riding, his jet skis, his water parks, how his son Kim Jong-un had a white puppy, for instance.
Yeah.
His Kipumjo girls, his party, his cognac habits, all come from one person who can't, you know, be confirmed or denied. So,
yeah,
I'm stuck with that.
So, I mean, this leads me to an interesting question. I mean, if we have, like, singular sources to work with, I mean, you know, again, I guess this goes back to what I was hoping to get from you in terms of imagination. I mean, is your imagination truthful enough to fill in the gaps? I mean, how did you deal with this problem writing this book?
It was my imagination truthful enough? That is a very twisted
yes,
question
it
you
is.
Just asked me. You know, when I first started, when I write fiction, I read nonfiction. I just love that stimulation. I love to research. And I just, as a general reader, I was working on something as a writer, and I just started reading books about North Korea, and they just were fascinating. And I went to look fairly early on by books by North Koreans. I went to there's a great library at Stanford, Green Library, and I found a couple books, but they were state-sponsored. You know, they'd been through the censors, and they glorified the regime. One was about a couple peasants, and, you know, they turn to the works of Kim Jong-il and double their work quotas and get a medal, and the people are fed. Another one was a great one called, it was the story of Ricky Dozon, North Korea's lone pro wrestler, which turned out to be a really resonant story for North Korea, and the North Koreans were really adamant about when I was there. But again, they're just pieces of glorification that pay homage to the state. I couldn't find a single novel, as we would consider it, a book that explores the human condition, that reveals the inward emotional sense of the self, that questions society in any way. And I don't know if people are writing them and sharing them and they don't get out. I don't know if people have written them and paid the ultimate price. I don't know if they don't even dare to do it. But we don't have evidence of them. And I just thought of a world where, you know, people didn't write books and where people didn't read books. And I thought about myself as a writer. What would I do there? I would have to write propaganda.
Yeah.
And of course I would, because my kids, I would need to survive. And so it was a place without a voice. And honestly, when I started reading the stories of people who'd gotten out, I became, I mean, duty and mission sound all highfalutin, but I kind of really felt like I had found these stories that I didn't know existed. And I felt some obligation to having had been exposed to them, probably. And I had to fill in that empty void of how people would behave under these circumstances. And I am a humanist. I do believe people are universal, that they all have humor and curiosity and hope and love. And so I used my own emotions there. But the truth is, we won't know until North Korean writers and artists can tell their own stories.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what I was trying to find out anyway at the beginning. Yeah. I'd be happy to trade my version, if it's wrong, for the right version of a writer who's finally free to write there.
But you, Adam, are writing in a very clear comic mode. At least when I read this book, I thought of the comic moments more than the moments in the DMZ tunnel and so forth. I mean, even the, you know, interrogators near the beginning, they're talking about, you know, putting the giving the professor alone time at the beginning of the second part.
Right.
The moment with Kim Jong-il where, you know, there's this absurd moment playing the guitar, also in the second part.
Yeah.
I mean, there is an inherent comic default, I would argue, in this book, and yet you also have this sense of duty. So, I mean, clearly, these two examples, I think, probably was these were a case of you kind of cracking yourself up. So, I mean, how did you stifle that at points when you needed to tell a very serious narrative?
I wouldn't say that I was clearly cracking myself up. You know, I do believe that there's humor in North Korea. I think it's just a fact. There are so many laughable things that come out of there because they take their propaganda so seriously, because they have such an insular version of themselves, because they glorify to the point of deification.
Yeah.
And, you know, I found a lot of the propaganda quite funny. And also, I think darkness and humor go hand in hand. And the unrelenting darkness that I encountered reading stories of gulag escapees was something I couldn't even get in the book.
Yeah.
It was so harrowing, it just overweighed everything. And honestly, a lot of the absurdity, the true life absurdity of the Kim regime, I had to edit out because it made the book unbelievable.
Yeah.
And lessened my characters. But the propaganda things that you laugh at are real. And
yeah.
I'm not trying to use, you know, fact and truth as the defense of literature. But let me tell you one anecdote. And this is true. You know, before Kim Il-sung died when he was still in charge, Kim Jong-il, when he was younger, and he was being groomed to be a leader, was put in charge of the state cinema agency. And he's a cinemaphile.
Yeah.
He has supposedly, according to Kenji Fujimoto, has 30,000 movies. I don't know if this is true or not. But what we do know is true is that Kim Jong-il decided to make a communist Godzilla movie. It's been suggested that he wrote the script personally. It's called Pulgasari, and you can, you know, look it up on YouTube. There's an English subtitle version. But to make this movie, because they don't allow artists in their own nation, because they have no one who can truly make something beautiful and resonant, he had to kidnap an actress, you know, Choi Yun-hee.
Yes, right.
From South Korea. And Kim Jong-il kidnapped her husband,
yes.
Shin Sang-gok, and he actually came looking for her, and then they captured him. I'd call that a kidnapping. They were given an ultimatum to make the communist Godzilla movie, and they refused, and they were imprisoned for years until they relented. And that's the craziest, most absurd, ridiculous thing in the world.
Yeah.
And yet, think of just being here in New York, it being snatched from your own life.
Yeah.
To be used by a crazy person in another country and imprisoned until you relented.
Yeah.
And of course, they made their crazy escape by getting the director's friends to debut it at the Cannes Film Festival.
Sure.
From which they escaped. Humor, absurdity, I mean Kafka-esque absurdity.
Yes.
And utter deprivation and darkness, all at the whim of one person. I don't think they can be separated, and I didn't try to.
From an American outsider standpoint,
yes.
You're going to have a totally different take, and you're more inclined to, I suppose, look in a mocking way at what's going on. Whereas if you're a North Korean living this nightmare, it is truly a nightmare, even though maybe there is a chance of them laughing over it later. So this brings to mind a question of moral responsibility,
right.
To get that truthful, horrific nature of what it is to be in the North Korean regime. So my question to you is, you know, what you did to combat that outsider notion were narrative devices such as the loudspeakers, sort of your way to form a conduit between the American outsider perspective and the North Korean insider perspective?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, the word mocking is, I feel, would be the opposite of my impulse.
Yeah.
I didn't try to capture the horrific nature of the regime. I think a lot of that's been done well by nonfiction. What's been missing is who these people are, how they interact, the choices they have to make. What happens when, if you can't express yourself, how does your humanity survive? How do you keep your own identity when one is given to you? Can you harbor it safely? Does it eventually disappear? These are questions I was curious about. As a parent, I was curious about how I would keep my family safe and whole in a place like that, which is what families there must go through. We know they must.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's any infraction to fill in my own hopes and fears mostly, when imagining that. And Kim Jong-il, actually, I think I took him as a very serious character. And the easiest impulse would be to South Park him. You know, I didn't give him big goofy sunglasses or bouffant hair or elevator shoes, the things we normally think of him. Actually, you know, most of the studies I read about him from people who'd encountered him said he was quite cunning, fiercely intelligent, that he'd survived many purges or attempted coups from his own, you know, military. One is as recent as 2005. They tried to blow up his train on the border, crossing the Yalu River. It leveled an entire town. It missed his train by like 30 minutes. And it was a bomb that destroyed 300 houses. You know, Madeleine Albright went there in 2000, and there's a Frontline documentary about her trip, and it includes footage from her trip. I love Madeleine Albright. She spoke about the crafty, cunning light in his eyes, his sharp sense of humor and insight, the delight he took in entertaining such a world leader, his great hospitality. And of course, he pulled a gigantic prank on her. He turned the lights out on the capital city of Pyongyang and drove her through a dark city to a surprise Ararang Festival gymnastic event in which 100,000 people were waiting to spring the lights on her for just her pleasure. So actually, I think he is a survivor. He's politically savvy. I'm talking about a dead person, of course.
Yeah. I know, it's interesting. I was going to say,
we're talking about the present tense.
Yeah.
As a character, he's still alive to me.
Yeah.
You know, and it will always be that way. And so I think I found his vulnerabilities. In the book, he needed one person with whom he could share his weaknesses, one person with which he could open his heart. In a world where everyone obeyed his every command, he almost wanted this one person, Sun Moon, to defy him.
Yeah.
And I think he is a humorous person, and I think that absurdity and ridicularity, which is a word I like, occurs when you have ultimate power. And it was a real challenge as a writer to write an omnipotent, omnipresent character, something I'd never done before.
Yeah.
But in the end, you know, he gets bested by the human heart and tricked by his own needs.
Sure.
And sure, there's humor there, but I would just say that without humor, he wouldn't be fully alive, as would all the characters be missing something, probably. And just to tackle the propaganda question, you know, Kim Il-sung in the early 70s wired the nation for, he called it an air defense system. We had kind of leveled the country. He did have a genuine concern. But it quickly became a propaganda tool. And it was a cable radio. He was afraid that we would be able to intercept his transmissions or jam them. So, you know, people have these loudspeakers in their apartment floors and housing blocks. Everyone who defects talks about growing up under them. Though, Ed, I couldn't find a single picture in all my research of one loudspeaker in one apartment.
Really?
And so it turned out to be utterly unverifiable, even though we have testimonies from thousands of people. And one of the people I went to Pyongyang with had talked about seeing them there on his previous trip in public plazas and hearing it in the escalators and the subways. But this propaganda I began reading the KCNA, which is the central news agency out of Pyongyang. The main newspaper in the capital is the Rodong Sinmun, which means the Workers' Party paper, basically. Yeah. The Japanese are obsessed with North Korea. They translate the KCNA every day into English, Japanese, and Spanish. And I've read the Rodong Sinmun like every day for the past 6 years.
Wow.
But, you know, religiously, not every single day, but religiously. And
you didn't get tired of the repetitive messages or anything?
Well, here's the thing about it. There, and I also listened to some broadcasts. They did an experiment in which they tried to answer VOA, in which the Americans and South Koreans broadcast propaganda to the North and Korean. The North Koreans, for a while, tried to broadcast their self-glorifying propaganda in English to the Americans in the South, to the military services.
It's like Pork Chop Hill all over again. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, in fact, your loudspeakers reminded me very much of the guy in Pork Chop Hill says, "You don't have to die."
Yeah. Sure. And so I really felt that we wouldn't get a sense of people's daily oppressive life under that propaganda. You can barely read it.
Yeah.
You can't listen to a minute of it. It's the opposite of information.
Yeah.
It is mind-numbing, and I did make a choice. I kind of felt that you couldn't get a sense of what these people toiled under unless you saw their loudspeakers.
Yeah.
And you couldn't get a sense of the absurdity of the place. Most of what comes over the loudspeakers is I sourced straight from the North Koreans. It's not my sense of humor.
Yeah.
It's our dramatic irony taking a read on it. But this is true. It, like the darkness, which overpowered the book, like the absurdity, which undermined the book, trying to give an American reader a sense of the propaganda under which those people toiled made the book intolerably boring.
Yeah.
And my solution was to use small doses of it and to let what I saw as the inherent humor in it shine.
Yeah.
And that was a choice. Maybe it was a bad choice, but
I had
to make it palatable.
Sure, sure. I also wanted to ask you about Sun Moon. You alluded to the kidnapped actress, and I'm wondering if there was any specific North Korean actress model, or was it related more towards the kidnapped actress from South Korea? Any specific figure that you were thinking of, or was this purely from the imagination?
You know, the North Koreans are famous for kidnappings, and all the kidnappings in my book are based on, you know, real events. And they kidnap from the Philippines, from Burma, from South Korea especially. Yeah. There are probably several Americans there right now, which made the irony of Bill Clinton going after two particular Americans while leaving people from all kinds of countries behind a little ugly, in my opinion. But anyway, I would say that to the character of Sun Moon, I just wanted a person who maybe had believed the propaganda. She was a star in propaganda movies. She was kind of a diva. I think she kind of believed this. And it wasn't until she saw a film made for a film's sake to reveal two characters, the love between them, the tough choices they have to make, and a movie that was just trying to examine the human condition of two people under fascism trying to escape together and the sacrifice one makes for another, a story that would never come about where she was from, and to just see for the first time a real work of art, which I consider Casablanca to be, and to make the realization that she had benefited from the system and therefore hadn't questioned it, which I think is true of a lot of the people in Pyongyang, or must be true. And she came to a shocking realization that everything she'd done was a lie.
Yeah. But what's also interesting with movies is that there's a lot of resistance to anything in black and white in the book. And so was that based also on your research, too? Did they?
Well, supposedly everyone's seen this movie, Titanic.
Yeah.
You know, the advent of the DVD supposedly pushed a big illegal trade in VHS tapes and VHS players across the Yalu and Tumen River, and normal people outside in the provinces were first exposed to movies because of that, you know, 15 years ago. But in the North, supposedly they have everything based on the testimonials of people.
Yeah.
The DPRK is changing a great deal. What I saw in 2007 was like a time capsule. I talked to people who went there in 2009 and 10, and to a couple of people who were just there in the fall, and they're like, there's an AP News office and a big new fancy, you know, shopping mall, and people are driving Hummers and walking around boldly talking on cell phones.
Yeah.
And Eric LaForge just posted a lot of pictures on his website, who I think is the greatest photographer of North Korea right now, of people on their cell phones. So, you know, A, I don't think there are experts on North Korea. I think you have to go into that knowing it. B, things aren't verifiable. You have Google Maps, satellite images, and first-person testimony is what you have to go on. And it's a place that's ever-evolving as well. So I have a stunted notion that's 4.5 years old that I think is out of date, but that's the version that went into play in my book. And I don't think you could measure Pyongyang today by it. Did I answer the question?
No. I think you did.
I got rambling.
Yeah, it's okay. Rambling is good on this. Actually, while we're on the subject of the visual films and photographs, I did read your Daily Beast article. And this goes back to what you were saying earlier about here is a country that doesn't have any sense of the written word. You took photographs. You allude to the Daily Beast piece of seeing a few things that other people didn't. But I'm wondering if photographs are really enough for you to create, I suppose, a new written word to compensate for the lack of words that you have available at your fingertips.
To create a new written word.
Yes.
For the lack of written word, meaning the lack of verifiable information or
the
lack
of
novels, them to tell, them,
the lack
tell
of
their
language,
own story.
The lack of language, the lack of that kind of thing. I mean, is photography and is film enough to fill in that gap?
Well, you know, here I'll give you an example.
Yeah.
Because I've read the paper, the Rodong Sinmun, a great deal, I know that the composition of their headlines, there's almost always a little story that casts the regime in a great light internationally. And it'll say, oh, the president of Burundi sent a basket of flowers, and oh, Charles Taylor sent his well wishes, and I think the people in that nation don't recognize a despotic nation, but it makes it seem like they're great players in a global community. Always there are updates on Kim Jong-il and his on-the-spot inspections, and oh, that he receives a lot of things, performances, you know, audiences. He always goes out into the field to inspect a plant or a facility.
Kim Jong-il is looking at things, the Tumblr. Have you seen that?
That's the thing. Yeah. Those are the pictures without the captions in which he offers advice on how to better the chicken factory.
Yes.
So those are all KCNA photos.
Yeah.
And so, but there are also, so there are messages to the people. There's messages to the regime to itself. There are often messages to the outside world. You can see, like, there are messages that suggest ways for self-reliance of the citizens for the failures of the state. And I remember one of the first ones I came across was like, it is seaweed harvesting season. It's washing ashore in great abundance, and it's properly cooked. It's talked about how nutritious it was, and you know, advocated that people, you know, take trips to Nampo to gather their seaweed, and they would say, oh, it's chestnut harvesting season is almost upon us. Get ready for it, citizens. But, you know, it's not until this date. And, like, ways for people to literally scavenge extra calories in the capital, you know, this paper is being approved for the rest of the country. So, you know, this goes back to the idea of the photograph. I took a couple photographs when I was near a state park in the whole nation's a state park, but, you know, a place that was clearly for the people, you know, near the Myoyang Range, and I saw a male and a female of parental age. I assumed they were married and were parents, and there were two kids kind of running through the branches, and the kids were knocking down chestnuts, and it was the time of year when that would happen. The kids would knock them down. They had little buckets they would gather them in. And the parents were looking around furtively. I was some distance away, but I had a zoom lens. And they looked uneasy. They were cracking them on some rocks. Then something happened, and the kids ran down. And they didn't run, but they moved quickly off into the woods. And I photographed that. And it's just like, trees and green, and I never posted it because you can't see anything. I interpreted that to be a family that was hungry, risking at least moderate peril by harvesting the chestnuts before it was legal for everyone to go harvest them.
Yeah.
But I can't tell.
Yeah.
And no one could tell me. So I don't know anything from that photograph.
Well, you also allude in that piece to things that you saw that you were diffident to some degree to photograph. And so this leads me to wonder whether memory might in fact be the mechanism to bridge the gap between, I suppose, the photographic and the written word.
Right.
To kind of go back to the question.
Well, this is a notion that I've been thinking about a great deal because I researched the book for many years and I wasn't writing nonfiction. I was writing fiction and I tried to take everything I could find, movies, documentaries, photographs on Flickr, satellite images, second source books, and narratives, most of which were on the internet. I couldn't even remember where I read them all. Like,
yeah.
Sometimes I try to reference one, I'd be like, what site was that on? And you know, were these sites pro-North Korean or anti-North Korean? I just wanted the stories, and I poured them into my head. And especially after I went to North Korea, I had this urge to write nonfiction.
Yeah.
But I wanted it to go into the book to make the portrait, to go into the mulch pile of my mind. If I'd have been writing nonfiction, I would have done my little note card for every, you know, made my bibliography page for all my sources.
Yeah.
But instead, I just poured it in. And now that I'm on the other side of the book and it's complete, it's almost like the Big Bang. Like, what was before it? Like, all I know is that I poured it all in and it made this thing.
Yeah.
And the research seems like another me in another time.
So nonfiction for you, writing it down, is actually getting in the way of advancing fiction.
That's right. Wow. I think it would have crystallized it. It would have formalized it into a narrative, encapsulated it into its own thing, instead of informing and attaching to decorator crab like my plot and characters, which I'd invented.
Yeah.
So
did you keep any notes whatsoever to have something to go back to?
Oh my God, I got thousands of pages of notes. I think I wrote 250,000 words for the book, and 140,000 went in. So hundreds of pages of just notes, but not just like bibliographical notes,
sure,
but musings, questions, postulations, a discussion with myself. And here's another thing, Ed. I'm on book tour, and I've been to many places, and I'm fortunate to do interviews like these because I care about the subject, and I think the book is an interesting book. And would raise a lot of questions with readers. But now I'm talking about the book like it's a thing other than the book. And I've noticed like I've started to form a narrative of the way I talk about the book that is not quite how I made the book or the book itself. You know, when you storytell, there are things that people respond to in interviews, and I find myself telling these anecdotes and it's separating itself into its own little story about the story.
Yeah.
And I don't like that either, but it's happening.
Yeah.
You
become subject to your own form of propaganda almost.
That may be. That honestly may be, because I've just made like a version of what I think the book is that is inherently different than what the book is or how I made it.
Yeah. Well, then how do you stay organic?
It makes you question like, you know, what is the difference between fiction and nonfiction?
Yeah.
And, you know, when I was a kid, I was lucky to have a father who was a storyteller and grandfathers who were storytellers. And they lived in South Dakota. And I remember going there in the summers, and they would all get storytelling. And they would tell tall tales from the South Dakota plains. They would tell very personal stories of growing up. They'd tell family legends. They'd recount stories of other people all the time. They'd retell each other's stories. Stories would grow and change. People would finish each other's stories. And never did anyone ever ask, is that story true?
Yeah.
And it was a question. I would just love being carried away by a story, just transported. And whether it was factual or not never mattered to me.
This sounds very much like the loudspeakers.
Well, it's true that in my nonfiction, there's fiction.
Yeah.
And that in my fiction, I just fill it with truth. And that's why it didn't work for me in journalism school. because I was a journalism major at the Walter Cronkite College at ASU, and I would go cover student council meetings or whatever it was I would cover, and I would feel that there was something that I believed was taking place that I couldn't document, and I would make up that perfect quote. It just seemed right to me, and my teachers always caught me.
So you made up quotes when you were at J school?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah,
wow. And, you know, I wasn't meant to be there,
yeah.
And I don't know why I was doing it, and, you know, I abandoned that ship for fiction. Yeah. But not before I broke all the dang rules of journalism.
Sure,
and,
sure.
You know, learned that. Now I'm very meticulous about how I discuss that with my students and the choices they should make. Because I've made my choices. I don't care.
So the irony here is that you're more meticulous with fiction than you are with nonfiction.
I don't know if I've thought it through to that degree, but... Yeah. I care about the story in both.
Yeah.
And when I need a little element to make the bridge or the line to make that perfect note or to change or appropriate something. And, you know, like, here's an example. You know, when I read about Camp 1418 and 15 and 22 and 5, et cetera, you know, I heard people testify to Abortion Day, you know, in Camp 14 and to, you know, the amputations and the executions and how everyone in the camp would have to, you know, participate by hitting with a stick the person until they're beaten into a pulp. And I couldn't put that into the book. But that sense of working people so they were dead and then stealing the last thing from them, you know, I tried to capture with the blood taking in the book, you know. And so... There's a you know, exsanguination from the state, and the blood of the dead and the dying and like are sent to Pyongyang to, you know, I guess, vitalize them. And I found no evidence of anything like that, but it seemed to capture, making up that, the essence of the harrowing nature of all the other stuff without the weight of it. So that was like a place where I had no research for that fact.
Yeah.
And fiction just lent itself perfectly, I think.
Sure. I wanted to ask you about Kim Jong-il again, because he reminded me in this book very much of Nixon in Coover's The Public Burning. This sort of larger-than-life caricaturish, almost to a caricaturish fault.
Right.
And I'm wondering, you know, what issues you may have had in terms of writing about a living figure at the time, and whether Coover was possibly an influence upon you. I mean, it seems to me that this may tie into your... life in J school as well, but I am curious about this.
Well, again, I mean, I'm not taking issue, but I think we see this character, you know, very differently. I really felt that I was trying to capture what might be the real him and to leave the caricatures out.
Yeah.
We don't see him on a jet ski. We don't see him drinking his $1,000, you know, cognac.
Yeah.
$1,000 bottle cognac.
We do hear about his golf game, though.
Yeah, from the loudspeaker. You know, his famous successes are not in the book. And we just see him lurking, pondering, interacting, being a troublemaker, attempting to control the lives of the people around him, just to these finite degrees, the minutiae of their lives. And we see him deriving pleasure from it.
Yeah.
But I don't think he's a character, at least in the way I see him and read him. I think he's a really humanized, toned down version. The morals of humanizing a dictator is probably a whole nother question that other people
and
know,
that may very well
about.
Be what I'm detecting here, in the sense that you can sanitize someone who is so extreme to a point, and they may still in fact be extreme.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the thing is, people say, "Oh, he's evil."
Yeah.
I don't believe that. Evilness is a part of him. People say that he's crazy. That is certainly not true. He is ridiculous. He is sinister. Well, he's alive in the book,
exactly.
You know? And I read his dialogue all the time.
So he's going to be alive as long as you're reading the book.
Well, I'm sorry to make him immortal in that way. But so, you know, back to just making a character that was real. Early on, the two things that drew me to the book were to the material. I didn't know I was writing a book for some time. I just, that's the way as a writer I process material. I sketch things, I toy with voices, I try to write some fun stuff from a propaganda. It grew into a short story, and then, I don't know, I just outgrew that even, but before I thought, oh, this is a novel. But this notion of Kim Jong-il and writing a real person into the book, I'll admit at the beginning I was drawn to the oral histories of survivors, so people who'd gotten out of that nation, the deeply traumatized people. And I'll admit at the beginning, I thought Kim Jong-il was hilarious. He was quirky and sadistic and ridiculous and absurd. But it was the stories of the people that won out. And at first I was gonna, you know, make Pulgasar. I was gonna try to weave some of these famously absurd elements of his life in there. But it lessened the book, it undermined it, and I left it all out. And it only
lessened the book, how so?
Well, you couldn't believe anyone because because he's not believable. The things he does is not believable, even though we must believe it because we know what happened. The fiction's the opposite. You have to make it believable. The worst criticism of fiction ever is like, I don't buy it.
Yeah.
That's the death of fiction, you know? And how could you buy it? His real life. So I left him out of the book, but as I researched and I thought about narrative and I was a couple years in, I kind of saw that he was personally responsible. He was the black hole whose dark gravity warped everything around him, and that the deprivation of every person in that country under a leader who had total control for every aspect was the total responsibility of him. I said that awkwardly, but you know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I haven't eaten any lunch. But that he was the great script writer. He had assigned the millions of secondary roles. And I kind of felt that if we didn't meet the man who was inherently responsible for all the suffering, for the person who ordered the kidnapping and the boat to go get the shrimp, who wrote the scripts for the actress.
Yeah.
He was the one, and if we didn't lay his eyes on him, we really wouldn't understand that place.
Yeah.
Even if I had to imagine him.
Do you think that physicality, physical description, was really the way to get this believability on the page? I mean, I think of, at the very beginning, there's that Red Cross refrigerator. I think of the buildings having to go up and go up all these stairs and all these interesting descriptions of what people have to do. And sometimes have to almost stay there for a while. Was this notion of geography a way for you to get this believability, out of curiosity?
That's how I made me believe it.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's a big part of my writing. I usually have to believe a landscape.
Yeah.
And then I usually have to believe a voice, even though, because I'm so far removed as an American from the Korean world. I started in the third person. So we looked at this world objectively through a professional distant narrator. And it was only after years that I attempt that first person part where I felt maybe I can try it. But, you know, the Soviets built a refrigerator factory in North Korea. And the North Koreans can keep it running but not improve it. And yeah, they make brand new 1960s refrigerator in the year 2012. And those fridges are everywhere. I saw them. And I guess for the reader, like when they see the basic surface of the book, it's true.
Yeah.
When they see goats on the roofs, I saw goats on roofs.
Yeah.
That Pyongyang at night, they only turn the power on all night.
Yeah.
A couple times a year when the foreigners come. Normally, yeah, it shuts down in the evening. But when I was there, it was a show town because all the foreigners had come for the Arirang Festival. And so they left the lights on all night. But you could see that the lights, most of the buildings, like maybe St. Petersburg, are like 20 to 24 floors high. You could see the lights were really thick through this first 8 floors about,
yeah,
that. And then it got really sketchy. And you could tell no one was living up top. And because people report, which I can't verify, that the elevators are notoriously bad and that people get trapped in them when the power goes out.
Yeah.
And so they have to walk. And supposedly, the rankings go like this. If you're a veteran from the war or a widow of the veteran, you get to live on the first floor. And so there's even prioritizations over who has to climb the least amount of stairs.
Yeah.
And it's the young couples who have to live up on the 9th floor because, yeah, they're healthy and whatever, vital. So all of those things that you see that you're like, oh my God, is this North Korea? It's North Korea to the best of my ability to, yeah, depict it. But you know, when people come on the stage, that's what I had to invent. And
so physicality allows, I mean, I certainly would think, why is there this Red Cross fridge? Why are there goats on the roof as I was reading the book? But, you know, how do you balance that with the people? And how do you balance that with the secondary characters? I mean, you can be verisimilitudinous up to a point. How did you negotiate that out of curiosity? Oh. That balance.
Well, there was a little first part of that question was like, you know, why and how are there goats on the roof? And I think my readers wonder, what the heck?
Yeah.
I made a decision early on to have no exposition in the book.
Yeah.
I wouldn't do any sidebars or do any rambling or tour guiding. And you just have to take it as a factual premise and go with that world and live in it. And trust me that the sense of that place is right.
But your belief in the physicality create the life of these characters? Maybe that's a better way of phrasing this.
Well, I wouldn't have continued with the project if I didn't believe that I had caught the surface of the place, at least. But what was below?
Yeah.
And that obsessed me. Who are these people? I thought about it constantly. How am I going to get them? And, you know, surprisingly, it was just like little moments in people's stories that... You know, Shin Dong-hook talks about, you know, when he escaped from Camp 14. You know, I think that here, maybe we are drawn to Sophie's Choice-like stories in which we think, oh my God, what some people must go through. It asks us to weigh the important things and to measure in our minds what we would do. I think probably everyone in North Korea has to make a Sophie's Choice-like decision in their lives. And in Shin's story, he was born in Camp 14. His father was a trustee. This is the worst of the worst camps. You don't ever get out. And because his father was trusted by the guards and was valuable in some way, who knows what services he did to receive that reward. Obviously, he was colluding with them and helping them to the detriment of other people. He was given a wife and he had two children. Shin Dong-hook was the younger. When he was about 14, he was pretty malnourished and pretty weak, and his family decided to escape, and they decided he was a liability. And Blaine Harden from the Washington Post is writing the story of this. It's coming out from Viking. So, and I've talked to him about how to tell the story of someone whose story can't be verified in any way as a journalist. But, you know, his parents decided that they had to leave him behind in a gulag.
Yeah.
And they went without him because that would improve their odds. And of course, they can't tell him because it would put him in danger. They were caught and executed in front of him, and he was tortured for it. And he has the burn marks, you know, to verify this experience on him. He kind of continued to toil for about 9 years until he was, I think, 24. And he was stronger and healthier, and he and a friend decided to make an escape. And they made a run at night, and they came to the electric fence. And, you know, there's this line haunted me that all throughout the writing of my book, that Elie Wiesel says that no one ever got out of a camp in the Holocaust without something to be ashamed of.
Yeah.
That to be one of the people who survived means you have to make a choice that came at the expense of someone else. And, you know, Shin, I've seen, there's a videotape of him telling the story, and he and a friend come to an electric fence, and his friend goes first, and Shin kind of goes to the third person and is a little passive, and his friend dies, and his dead body weighs the wires down and provides space for Shin to climb over it. And Shin then escapes to the countryside. It's a true allegory of the cave. He doesn't even know the world he's in. He doesn't know he's wearing a haircut that identifies him as a gulag prisoner. He thought everyone had them. He goes to a house, and on the wall, these people risk their lives to harbor him and help him get toward freedom. But on the wall, he sees pictures of these two guys, and he says, "Who are they?" And they're like, "This is Kim Jong-il and Kim Il-sung." And he says, "I've heard their names before. Who are they?" And he was informed that they were the leaders of their nation. And because he was truly expendable, there was no indoctrination in the prison. They didn't waste any breath on indoctrinating them. And this notion that you wouldn't know the propaganda of the leaders in the most indoctrinating place in the world, like, helped me shape a whole realm of the book and the characters and how they would see the world. And, you know, the test for me was, even though it's a humorous section, and I think when they go to Texas, it's quite funny to see the Americans through the North Koreans' perspective. You know, when my characters finally went there 100 pages in, I did see the Americans through North Korean eyes. I believed that I was looking at my own society through this lens. And that's when I first thought, you know, this book might just work.
Yeah.
I think.
What about being, one last question, what are you about being one of the first American novels out of the gate? I mean, maybe this goes back to my question of moral responsibility, but to some degree, this book might be said to be setting the tone for future North Korean books, although there are a few novels coming out, as we've mentioned earlier. I mean, you know, did this weigh on your mind? Was it just, I suppose, serendipitous? What of this dilemma? I mean, do you feel that there's any real need to get it right, or will someone else correct you?
Well, why haven't writers taken on this topic of the most mysterious place in the world? It is endlessly interesting and fascinating to me. It obsessed me and captivated me. The plights of the people, the craziness, the geography, the insularity, the violence, the full range of human possibility is there, even as people are clipped down to their least possible selves. Why haven't other people written about this place? We write about all Japan and the Africa and the past and the future.
Maybe they're not allowed to. Maybe the publishing industry creates needless restrictions against any sort of non-American perspective.
I wonder.
Yeah.
And, you know, there have been a couple South Korean books about North Korea translated.
Sure.
But, you know, they're thrillers. They're, you know, kind of genre pieces. And they're not really after, like, some portrait that bears some reality, emotional reality.
Is this, to some degree, perhaps why this book became a thriller to some degree? Sort of, you need to have some commercial instinct in order to write about this subject? Or?
Well, I know my publisher thinks that word thriller is going to make them a lot of money.
Yeah.
The word never occurred to me when I was writing the book.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, they're in business. They're trying to sell a book. I didn't object to the word. I think it's a page-turner. If someone's coming to the book expecting a thriller, I'm not going to fulfill the conventions that they're used to, and the book would give them something else.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that would be a disappointment or not. But there's a novel called Gia that I read, set in North Korea, by a woman who did a lot of research with defectors in southern China. That was the only book I could really find. There's the James Church books, which are police procedurals, which are pretty fascinating. And I know the person who helped him get his visa in North Korea, so I know he has been there many times. And his surface of the world is fabulous, too. And I enjoyed reading his books. They're quite fun. You know, a crime detective in a world without crime.
Yeah.
You know, people told me, you're going to go to the safest place on earth where crime doesn't exist. There's a total monopoly on violence by the government. And I don't know if that's true or not, but I didn't see any crime going on. So, I mean, why wouldn't, if writers are going to use their imaginations to go to new worlds and find new possibilities and explore themselves and their own lives from these distant points, you know, why wouldn't? It's really weird that no one else was writing a book set there. Of course, it would be very different than mine. I've got a quirky sensibility, and I do have my affinity for absurdity. You know?
Yeah.
But it seemed to suit. I'm also a heartfelt writer. I'm a funny writer. I'm an absurd writer. I'm a scene-based writer. I like to work out intricate narratives. You know, this is my book. It's all my strengths pulled together and interests. I didn't eat lunch. I'm really rambling now.
No. It's okay. I think that's a good sign for you to eat lunch. But Adam, thanks so much. It was a pleasure to chat with you. I appreciate it.
That's my man over here. Hey man, let me ask you a question, man. See if you know what's up. Pick this. Who fuses the music with no illusions? Producing the blueprints, clueless automator. Defy the laws of nature. Electronic monolith, throw a jam upon the disc. The futuristic looping with the quickness. Hyper producing hydrogen fusion liquids. Keep your distance.